first matter on our agenda is it was the decision of the At-Large Advisory Committee that we would be doing the finalisation and ratification of an ALAC statement on the proposed bylaw amendments on the board member term transitions. We actually have a blank page up there, tabula rasa. Now, with tabula rasa, that basically means we've got less than 12 minutes to write it, or we throw some high-level objectives around and agree on those and send perhaps a two- or three-person team off into the corridors later over lunch or supper to put into some semblance of efficient language what our high-level concepts are on this. Is it the will of the ALAC that we go in that direction, that we discuss for a few minutes here what we want in the statement and we create a ad hoc drafting team at this meeting to make the magic happen? Thank you, Alan.
Can I ask for someone to remind us why we decided this was one we needed to answer?
Well, from my memory, it was because we had commented on in the board review process on this particular action, and it was suggested that even if it wasn't particularly wordy, it would be appropriate for us to reiterate that we have a statement and we, you know, certainly want it to happen. But if you want to pull it, put that forward as a motion.
I'm not sure. Are we going to say anything other than we think it's a good thing?
Goes to the table. Are we going to say anything other than we think it is a good thing?
Does anyone think
it's
a bad thing? I mean, the change for those who haven't focused on it is primarily saying the transition in directors will not happen 6 months to the day after the end of an annual meeting, but will generally happen at the next annual meeting if it's positioned in roughly the right place, with a whole bunch of fallback language for what happens if it's not in the right place and what happens if it's cancelled and what happens if. But basically it says a director will, the SO and AC directors will take their positions not 6 months after the after this Friday, but at the end of the San Francisco meeting in this particular case, I believe.
So is there anyone who feels this is something we should object to? Because we certainly thought it was a good idea when we responded last time. Well, it seems to me that we simply have... Oh, sorry, again, Dijani, go ahead.
I am sorry, Alan, I didn't understand your point. I didn't understand your point. What I know is that the director will be sitting at the end of this meeting for a transitional period.
This is general, not our own.
Yeah, this is not in reference to our own, although it is applicable to our own. It says any SO and now AC or ALAC member will start their regular positions. Right now they start them 6 months after the end of the meeting. So they start them in between meetings with no transition, no staff briefing necessarily or any of that, because many of them are not picked yet at this meeting. And the change says they will synchronize the seating of a director, if meeting timing allows, with the end of an annual general meeting. I assume the end. It may be the beginning. I don't remember, but I think it's the end. Just to allow... training, to allow reasonable transition from the old members to the new members and that kind of thing.
With that explanation, Alan, and it's hugely important. We have been concerned about the effectiveness of transition and how succession planning and transition goes. This is hard stop and fresh start business is very worrying because people take a while to get up to speed. Let me, if I may, read to the record exactly what we're being asked to respond to. This is not the full documentation. This is a synopsis, of course. The bylaw amendments, which are proposed, do three things. One, define that if a meeting occurs between 6 to 8 months after the conclusion of an ICANN annual general meeting, the board seat transition should occur then. Two, If no meeting occurs during that time, the board seat transition will occur as they do now, 6 months after the conclusion of the AGM. And three, require that those selecting board members to give an additional month of notice of their selection, which will allow for more comprehensive board committee slating to be completed before the transition terms. The bylaw amendments, we should note, do not require ICANN to hold a mid-year meeting. They do historically, but there is no requirement. So, I mean, what we're talking about here is something that will allow, I think, a certainly better transition, and I'm supportive of these bylaw amendments, but it will, in the future, affect us in one way, and that is our own processes for selection will need to move back at an appropriate time to allow the chair of the ALAC 1 month earlier to be able to announce who that is. Now, I don't think that's a huge impost once every 3 years.
If the ALAC wishes that we respond to this, I would be happy to draft the one sentence that I think we need to say.
Anyone object to that? Delighted. The job is yours, Alan. Thank you very much.
It was that or spend the next 20 minutes discussing it.
No, we didn't have 20 minutes. Have we got in? Good, good. I was going to say, now, seeing as we don't have Patrick ready, what we might do then is discuss the process by which this one sentence will be ratified. What we might do now is call for a motion to be put that the affirmative statement, Alan, help me here. How are you going to word this? You're just going to say, can you give us a rough idea of what one sentence is going to be that we...
No. I'm not sure what the motion is. You're trying to pass the motion in the absence of the actual wording.
Well, I'd like to be able to say that we have a particular time in a particular way that we are going to ratify or not this motion and get this thing in on time. Therefore, if you can give us some idea what it's going to say.
What it will say is, at large, or the ALAC supports the intent of the motion and encourages the board to ratify it.
Okay.
So and I will have it by the near the end of this morning's meetings if you'd like to reschedule a 20-second period for the vote,
okay.
Then we
so
can do it.
Can I suggest then... Go ahead, Sebastian.
I just wanted to move the motion that Alan will write in the near future.
In the very near future. Is it possible then, Alan, because I didn't want to pressure you too much, actually, although I seem to have managed to, with our second session after morning tea, we could actually do a ratification then? Because if that's the plan, that's fantastic.
That was what I was suggesting.
Okay. In which case, we don't have to wonder about how we ratify. We'll be ratifying later in this session. Thank you. Excellent. So, I guess I can call for any other business at this point. Patrick, on perfect timing. That's a piece of magic. Congratulations, sir. We very rarely run early in this room, and the fact that you were available has made my life a whole lot easier, because song and dance is just not what I'm up to at this hour of the morning. So.
It helps a lot.
Okay. So just while the administrivia gets organised here, and Patrick gets his... there we go. Oh, look at that. Absolutely perfect. Thank you for joining us, Patrick. We are now going to have a staff briefing from Patrick as the acting coordinator of the security group. And we're queued. Over to you.
Well, great. So thank you, everyone, for having me give this briefing. As you know, I gave a briefing on the FY11 SSR plan back in about a month ago. And that was really helpful because the comments from the at-large was really the first inputs that we received on the plan. And what I want to be able to tell this group about briefly is that we took that input. I think we did an example for how accountability and transparency is working, because we noted very clearly with the inputs received, took that, posted a very thorough summary and analysis of comments, and then we published a red line attributing where those inputs came from and a clean version. So, and we've made that available. It's in the process of translation, so that will take a little bit of time, but we're making progress, and you know, this group had a big input in that. So thank you. Are you advancing?
Great. Yeah.
Great. So on November 10th, we posted the summary and analysis of inputs on the SSR plan. Many of the observations were supportive of the activities and the explanation of ICANN's role in security, stability, and resiliency. But we received some very good input asking for clarification in several areas, that particularly that ICANN not expand beyond its mission and its bylaws, and made some suggestions on how to improve some language, particularly around compliance activities that relate to security, as well as activities in areas such as around RPKI, so resource public key indicators. And you know, so we took that, and then there was also quite a bit of feedback of the feedback received that more work should be done around system-wide analysis of risks and threats to the system. And this is one that I know at large is participating in the DNS security and stability analysis working group. And I understand that the charter is up for consideration in the different ACs and SOs this week. So I'm really looking forward to, once that is done, to providing inputs and working with the community to get some real data and have it to take a step back and look at what there really is going on, and then appropriate responses can develop from that. So, Matthias, the next slide. As I mentioned, we posted a red line and a clean version. This is the link to where it can be found in two different places. It's available on the security team page, and as well as it's underneath the original SSR plan, and translations will be published soon. But it's so that if you're wondering how your comments were taken into account, the red line's there, but you can also see the updated version as well. So I want to thank at large for contributing. What we want to do going forward is do a better job of engaging earlier. And we'll be reaching out after the first of the year, most likely in February, before the ICANN meeting in San Francisco, and then trying to, and we've received this input from ESSAC as well, that the plan that ICANN follows should be one that's more streamlined, less repetitive, and has more actionable tasks. So if at large can help in calling out areas, that we'd really appreciate it. Just a brief note, some of the discussions coming up this week. Next slide. Today is the kickoff for the Affirmation Review Team on Security, Stability, and Resiliency. They have a closed session today, but tomorrow they'll have an open session from 9 to 10 a.m. And the ESSAC has their open meeting later this morning. And then within each of the SOs and ACs, there'll be discussion of the charter. So hopefully you have time blocked off for that. In the briefing that I did for At Large, I referenced that it might be good to mention some observations that we're seeing in the system and just raise it as these are some of the things that might be good for discussion later on. I unfortunately don't have the time to do that at this meeting, but maybe it's something that can be raised in the San Francisco meeting. Can you advance the slide? So this is, you know, we're seeing an increase in threats that leverage the DNS, such as using domain name generation for command and control activities, such as with Configure, and there's another form of botnet called Zeus and its variant called LICAT. I just want to reference it for now, and we can bring it back at another opportunity. In fact, I could do a briefing call or receive some input that the community might be seeing between now and San Francisco. So if you want to see what available times are, then I'm happy to do that. On the next slide, we note that there's some risks in the system, and there'll be a number of venues for this to be discussed, including in the advisory group that once it's formed. And these include looking at denial of service attacks against registrars, registries, and social networks, issues around the adoption of DNSSEC, routing errors. There's a well-known error that included a redirection of IROOT earlier in the year. And then new things that are developing, like Stuxnet. So it's using the domain name system to for command and control on systems that might not have previously been connected to the internet, or where control systems for plants and production of or energy facilities. And this is one that the at large might be interested in talking about, as well as natural disasters that might affect DNS service. So this ties into the next slide is, as a group, we need better data, and I'm hoping that the working group will help us get there, as well as some recommendations for DNS risk management models and metrics. And the main message is that we want to collaborate with the community rather than force particular avenues for that happening. And with that, I'll open it up to questions.
So, go ahead.
Could you elaborate just a little bit on Stuxnet? I'm not familiar with that.
So, this is something that was in the news in the last couple months of if I'm understanding it correctly, it was using for the first time the DNS to deliver malware to disrupt particular plants, as in nuclear facilities in Iran, and using the DNS in a way to deliver something that might take those offline. And so this is one where there's quite a bit of research. I can provide links to that research from experts. It's not something that ICANN is really involved in, other than I'm raising it as something that this group might want to be aware of. Because there is, command and control for energy facilities and nuclear power plants previously may not have been connected to the internet, or had there wouldn't be a way for the domain name system to be exploited to cause harm. And now Stuxnet, for the first time, is seen as a way that the internet was used as a way to try to disable a nuclear facility. So this is something that should be, for awareness raising for this group and for the community. And I might not be explaining it in the right way. So rather than be seen as the authority, I should provide some information where there is accurate description of what happened.
Thank you, Patrick. And, of course, that also helps if we get reference points, then that allows us to distribute that information regionally and locally with our ALSs.
Yeah. So, I mean, experts at Symantec and Siemens have published quite a bit of authoritative data on this, and I'm just raising it as this is something that's happened in the space.
Okay. Follow on, Bo, and then Evan.
Yeah, could you just indulge me with a brief similar explanation of LICAT? I don't know that one either.
So LICAT is a variant on the Zeus botnet, which is using domain name generation to activate malware on machines that had already been previously infected by botnets. So it was using a similar method as the Conficker to distribute malware and to create links between computers. And again, that might not be the best description of what it is, but LICAT is something that's fairly new, or at least a new variant of something that was previously in existence. And it's just a what I should do is provide more information rather than describing it in general terms.
You're right then, Bo? Yep.
Yes, thank you very much.
Evan?
One of the concerns that has occasionally arisen within ICANN is the issue of feature creep and the idea of ICANN sort of going outside the bounds of simple issues of the domain numbering and domain name issue. So on something like Stuxnet, absolutely, it's really, really serious. But to what extent do you identify the role that, like, is Stuxnet in the way that it's spread in this new sort of generation of very specifically targeted things or whatever, how much of a role is ICANN relevant issues in dealing with that particular security issue? Especially, for instance, if they're going directly to IP addresses as opposed to names, what's the role of ICANN? What's the role of the domain name system in dealing with these security issues?
So because some of these exploits are using domain name generation to deliver their impacts, then that is the connection for ICANN. But in this case, I'm raising it for awareness because at large and its component ALSs are at the, in some cases, closest to where you might feel the impacts, and where it's not something that ICANN is directly involved in, we're providing a forum, sharing information, and making it available so that there might be local law enforcement or others that are closer to where it's impacting you. And I think it helps that we're here to provide information rather than to direct or lead.
Thank you for that, Patrick. Any other questions? And are there any questions from the audience? We're very open and we're very friendly, and we'll provide a microphone, although there's usually one on a stand. If anyone wants to come forward and just grab a mic from one of us, there's one sitting next to me if you're game.
And I'm sorry if I can't stay longer, but I am in between
three
things. So
one thing just before you go there, Patrick, you very wisely or very foolishly offered a couple of briefings there.
Yep.
It would be my opinion that particularly the regional leaders around the table would be very keen on those. So if we can get staff to liaise on times, probably Matthias working directly with the regional leaders, is there a blackout time in the next, because we're talking between now and San Francisco, there's some other things perhaps happening in your life. Are there some blackout times?
Yeah. I'd say if we could look to a January timeframe, which is, you know, between now and you know, it fits nicely in the middle before the next ICANN meeting, I think it would be helpful. And if it's useful information, I'm happy to keep doing this. It just, unfortunately, I'm a little crunched for time right now.
Thanks for that. It's just that the regional secretaries have a meeting and they can then focus on getting dates that suit you.
January.
January it is then. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Now, have we made the magic happen, and is Margie now going to mysteriously appear?
I'm hoping she will, but just a few moments. Because
if the magic isn't going to happen, we could probably bring forward the charter for the joint work group on SSW, which is something slated for in part two later, but we can probably bring it forward and look at a fairly, I think, familiar story now. This new version, I'm filibustering while staff find it, this new version of cross-community work group that we do shared development of terms of reference has resulted in a very new concept here, which is the GNSO and the CCNSO, who as the support organisations, it's their job to do PDP processes and develop policy. And under normal circumstances, they would be chartering work groups in their own name and perhaps, as they have done in example for the Fast Track IDN, make them cross-community work groups and have the GAC and the ALAC and other influences in, but they've been previously single SO charters. So you have what's called a CO, a chartering organisation, and they're primarily in charge of such a work group. The beast you have in front of you is something entirely new, entirely different, and I think very exciting from an at-large point of view. This is a very formal, very new thing, which is a joint DNS security and stability analysis working group. And it's in your which confused me, I've got to tell you. It's in your agenda as a JASWG, but it's the work group, which is what I've been involved with, was actually DSSAWG. So I was looking for SSAs, and all I was finding was other letters. But this is actually a co-chartered work group. So the CCNSO will be approving this charter, the GNSO will be approving this charter, and it is desired that the at-large advisory committee approve this charter. Now, once that's happened, that's actually a fairly landmark moment because this is a new beast we're creating. And for that reason alone, I'm very excited about it. Was this in the dongles that everyone got? Is this material that people have had time to read? Okay. Please come forward.
If there's a paper copy, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, paper will suddenly appear, and I'm very apologetic that even though it's an agenda item, it is not on your thumb drives. That mea culpa. I'm sorry. Get a brown bootlace and beat me up with it later. It's all my fault. But what we can do is read through it. It's not a particularly extensive charter, and anyone who's been involved in one of the recent cross-community work groups or a GNSO work group running under the new version will feel a certain flavour coming through. So if we can make this slightly larger for the blind woman at the front of the room to be able to read it, that would be good. And if possible, as Mohammed pointed out during Patrick's presentation, if by chance we were able to get these things also in the Adobe chat room, then those of us who have that chat room open on our screens in front of us, or those of us who are remotely participating, would find reading and seeing these things so much more easily. Or not. Okay. I will do my best. Unless, Beau, how's your dulcet tones? You're in good voice?
Yes, fairly.
Well, would you care to read it? Because to me it's an at-large blur.
Joint DNS... Just read it?
Maybe you should stop the background.
Huh?
Background.
At their meetings during the ICANN Brussels meeting, the At-Large Advisory Committee, ALAC, the country code names supporting organization, CCNSO, the generic names supporting organization, GNSO, the Governmental Advisory Committee, GAC, and the Number Resource Organization, NROs, acknowledge the need for a better understanding of the security and stability of the global domain name system, DNS. This is considered to be of common interest to the participating supporting organizations, advisory committees, and others, and should be preferably undertaken in a collaborative effort. Is that too fast?
Oh, I'm not getting signals from interpreters who are panicking.
To this end, the ALAC, CCNSO, GNSO, and NRO agreed to establish a joint DNS Security and Stability Analysis Working Group, DSSA-WG, in accordance with each own rules and procedures, and invite other ACs to liaise and engage with the DSSA-WG in a manner they consider to be appropriate. Objectives and goals. Slower. The objective of the DSSAWG is to draw upon the collective expertise of the participating SOs and ACs, solicit expert input and advice, and report to the respective participating SOs and ACs on A, the actual level, frequency, and severity of threats to the DNS, B, the current efforts and activities to mitigate these threats to the DNS, and C, the gaps, if any, in the current security response to DNS issues. If considered feasible and appropriate, the DSSAWG may identify and report on possible additional risk mitigation activities that it believes would assist in closing any gaps identified under item C above. Each of the participating SOs and ACs has adopted this charter according to its own rules and procedures. 2.2, scope of activities. The DSSAWG should limit its activities to considering issues at the root and top-level domains within the framework of ICANN's coordinating role in managing internet naming. Scroll. And numbering resources as stated in its mission in its bylaws. The DSSAWG also should take into account and attempt to coordinate with existing, ongoing, and emerging research, studies, and initiatives with respect to the DSSAWG objectives. Subject to the limitations above, the DSSAWG should do whatever it deems relevant and necessary to achieve its objectives. The DSSAWG shall take a proactive role in fostering participation and input from the relevant communities and expert groups and provide regular feedback and the opportunity to comment to the participating SOs and ACs and the ICANN community in general on its progress. All DSSAWG members are encouraged to keep their respective groups updated and to solicit feedback and provide that feedback to the DSSAWG. If issues become apparent to the DSSAWG that are outside of its scope, the DSSAWG co-chairs shall inform the chairs of the participating SOs and ACs in a timely manner so that appropriate action or remediation can be taken.
Bo, I think now that we've filibustered enough to get Margie here and I've given the link out and it is on an agenda item later, I'm going to get down on bended knee, well, virtually on bended knee, and say thank you very much for helping us through that. Ladies and gentlemen, as our next speaker is here, what I'd like you to do, you've got the background, you understand where it's coming from. I'm going to request that you have a look at that PDF. You have the link, you will have hard copy shortly. And therefore, we will be making a resolution move with very little discussion this afternoon. I expect you to have all read it and come ready with questions or clarifications. We'll move straight to the discussion of a resolution to ratify this charter when we get to that this afternoon. Go ahead, Sebastian.
Sorry, when you say this afternoon, it's the next session or it's really this afternoon?
My apologies. It is part two, which is after coffee. I'm so used to these things running all day that my head was in afternoon. Mea culpa twice.
It's just because
it won't happen a third
time. I have
a
comment and I will not be able to be with you.
Well, please
put
it to the record now.
Yeah, I made it during the discussion of the this document. I have trouble with the organization name, and it's my feeling is that it will set up a precedent, and I am not sure that we will want that. It's that we are talking about AC and SO, and we are talking about NRO, and within ICANN, the organization in charge of address. It's ASO, and it's okay. They are friends, and NRO it's close to ICANN, but it's not inside. And the reference after would say ACs and ASOs, and I have trouble with that. That's my point. I would have preferred to have ASO, and maybe somewhere NRO will act as on behalf of the ASO somewhere. But that's my concern. Thank you.
So noted, Sebastian, and I will ensure that in your absence I also read back The response when you raise that in the work group, there was a response on behalf of the ASO and the NRO and the drafters. So I will go back to that red line version, and I will make sure that everyone understands what the reaction was from the drafting group to your concerns. Thank you. Okay, Margie, over to you. RAA. Now, what's this RAA thing? Some of us, you'll have to explain.
Sure. Hello, everyone. I always love speaking to you all. I'm here to talk to you about the RAA, which is the Registrar's Accreditation Agreement. And this is the agreement that ICANN signs with all its registrars to allow them to register domain names. And I'll provide you with some background of where we are with respect to the project. The project that we're dealing with is trying to explore amendments to the RAA to improve the terms and conditions and to include additional protections that might help registrants, help ICANN do compliance, and address some security-related concerns. So to give you some background, in 2007, ICANN underwent this comprehensive review of the RAA after the whole RegisterFly disaster took place. Paul Toomey essentially instructed staff to commence a process to amend the RAA. That led to 2009, where the RAA was approved by the GNSO Council, but it was only approved with the agreement that the RAA would be further analyzed. Because the concern in the community was that there weren't enough community involvement in the process of developing the new RAA, and therefore we wanted to provide opportunity to explore further to see if additional amendments could be addressed. So in 2009, in June, the board approved the new form of the RAA. And at that time, a joint working group with the at-large community and with the GNSO commenced its process to identify additional amendments and to work on what was called a Registrant Rights and Responsibilities Charter. We published a report in May of 2010 for public comment, and in October we filed the final report, which includes a lot of this information, and I'll talk about this today, and I've provided the link for the report there. So essentially what the group was tasked to do was to do a couple things. First, to draft a charter that was comprised of the registrant rights and responsibilities that are outlined in the current RAA. So that was the first task. The second task was to identify potential topics for future amendments to the RAA. And the third task was to identify a process and a timeline to move forward with these proposed amendments. And that is what the work of this group did for over a two-year period. The first task was the Rights and Responsibilities Charter, and this language actually came from, I believe it was an ALAC request, that there be a website that identifies the existing rights available to registrants. I think the concern was that there was more information would be useful so that registrants could understand what rights and responsibilities arise out of the RAA. So what we did is we put together a charter that explains this. The language came from the simplified language that staff had developed with regard to the non-lawyer's guide to the RAA. So we tried to use language that was less lawyer-like and more, plain English so that it could be understood by registrants. And the next steps with regard to this charter is that as per the contract, which says that if a rights and responsibilities charter is developed in consultation with the registrars, that the registrars would be required to link to it. So the next steps, as identified in the report, is that staff, assuming that the GNSO Council adopts its motion, would begin this consultation process with the registrars to try to actually implement this web page that would have information for registrants on what rights and responsibilities there are under the RAA. As part of this process, a number of participants, including from the at-large community, were concerned because the charter only talked about existing rights and responsibilities. So a project that came from the members from the at-large community was to try to identify what was called an aspirational charter, which would describe rights and responsibilities that should be afforded to registrants. And so the report actually provides information on that. And Bo Blendler, I see you in the corner there, Bo, was instrumental in working on that. I think this group will be interested. When we published the report for public comment, there was a lot of comments, particularly from the business community, indicating an interest in exploring this aspirational charter further. They thought that this was a good idea, and there might be additional work that is envisioned if the at-large community and the business community want to get together and explore what this aspirational charter should look like. So the report essentially outlined a lot of topics to be considered in amending the RAA. We spent the year going through a process of soliciting input from various members of the community on what should be included in the RAA, and we received input from various groups, from members of the at-large, from the law enforcement community. We actually had representatives from the law enforcement community present their recommended changes, and as well as ICANN staff. ICANN staff had put together what we thought from a compliance perspective we would like to see into the RAA. And the group took all these comments and topics. There was about 160 topics, so it was a very large list. And we tried to filter them down to what we considered high priority and medium priority topics. And so what you see here are what the report and the working group felt were high priority topics for amendments to the RAA that should be considered by the GNSO. And as you look through them, you can see they're pretty substantial. A lot of them are things that you've, the community has asked for many years. And they could cover things such as a prohibition on registrar cyber squatting. There's a recommendation that there should be some provisions related to malicious conduct, that there should be a registrar duty to investigate. And I'm not going to read these all. You can see them on the slide deck, and I think those are probably posted for further information. But these are the types of things that the community felt that were high priority items. Next slide, please. And the list continues. We narrowed the list to about 12, thinking that it would be good to have 12. Just so you know, go back, Gisela, please, for the previous slide. These listed are not listed in order of priority, so number 12 is not less important than number 1. It's just that they felt that of all the amendments, these 12 should be ones that have high priority. Next slide, please. The next category of amendment topics were what we considered medium priority, so they weren't as important as the first 12 list. And these, as you can glance through them, have a lot of interesting amendment topics, such as dealing with verification whenever there's a false WHOIS report, service level agreement for WHOIS, disclosure obligations. And so, as you can see, these are items that were felt to be medium priority, but still things that the group felt should be explored further. So the next steps, and this was the final part of the report, was trying to identify how we take these topics and actually go to the next step and produce a new form of RAA. And so the report had agreement on several features, but there was opposition within the group about one key point, and that was with regard to the negotiation process itself. The drafting team felt that there was strong support for including observers in the negotiations, which would be observers that would represent interested of non-affected parties. There was substantial opposition from the registrar community that felt that there's no place for third parties in the negotiations, but that they still wanted to have a process that would include regular reports to other parties, but that the negotiations themselves would be limited to ICANN staff and the registrar community. And then there were also some sub-team members that felt that there should be a broader role for non-parties, and then they should actually be full participants in the negotiations. So that was where there was a breakdown in the working group, and there was no consensus, although you can see the strong support position. Next slide, please. So essentially where we are at the moment is that the GNSO Council, and I didn't provide the whole motion, but just so you know where we are with respect to this topic within the council, we'll be voting on a motion on Wednesday to adopt Process A. And Process A is the process that addresses that allows observers. That's the process that the motion addresses. It also encourages the adoption of a process that includes evaluating the high priority and the medium priority topics, and it encourages adoption of the rights and responsibilities charter that's listed in the report, so that work can be continued and that the charter can be finalized, and now registrars would be able to post this information for registrants. So that is what the motion is, and it will be it's currently scheduled to be voted on Wednesday in the GNSO Council meeting. And that's essentially my report. I think it's probably a good time to open up for questions from you all.
Thank you, Margie. I've become the virtual Cheryl. I have a question myself, but Bo, I think, had his hand up first. Go ahead.
Thank you, Margie, for all the work and work and help that you did throughout this process. I have a comment and a question. The comment is that if there were a more confusing way for ICANN to have gone about this process, I can't think of what it might be. The working group process was difficult and painful, to say the least, and I'm not trying to blame that on anyone, but it seemed that there a great deal of work that the at-large side had to do was basically the old complaint about stenography. In other words, it felt like what we were doing was preordained. So that comment leads to my question, which is there a manner in which ICANN can help support or at least publicize some kind of get-together between at-large and perhaps the business community and perhaps members of the NCSG who might be interested in this, to try to make the aspirational charter a bit more substantial? Because at the moment, it's really only six or seven kind of vague points. I think that we're mostly, I think that just much more thought and effort needs to go into this from our point in order to make the next step worthwhile. So the question is, how can we go about getting some organizational ICANN support for doing that?
I suppose the easiest way of doing it is to have a motion in the GNSO Council to explore this. It's not part of that current motion that I posted up on the website. Just so you know, from the weekend sessions that we had with the GNSO Council, it's not likely they will vote on this on Wednesday. There's a lot of debate and discussion that still needs to happen. And as that process goes forward, although, Alan, you're not a voting member, but you could certainly raise that issue of whether the aspirational charter should be, you know, should be part of the next steps.
Yeah, I can't formally make motions either. I can certainly raise the issue. It would be useful if there was some other counselor who was already on board, who would be prepared to actually make the motion and defend it. So I'll talk to Bo separately.
And Bo, just to remind you, I mean, obviously you knew this when we were working on the group together, but it was INTA that was interested in this discussion. So you have, you know, IPC and, you know, strong business support for really taking a deep dive into this special charter.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to hear that. And also there's a lot of wording in the ICANN strategic plan now about registrants' rights and whatnot. So to have the material for that come from the user and even the business community, as opposed from the registrar community, would be most excellent.
Okay. I'll turn the session back to Cheryl. The speaker list right now is me, followed by James.
Well, rather than introduce yourself, go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. 2 points related. During the discussion of how should users be involved in the negotiation process, did anyone ever raise the issue that, yes, the negotiation is a two-party negotiation between ICANN and the registrars, but ICANN has the right to say who their people on the negotiating team are? And I don't think there is anything which says they must be employees of ICANN. You may well have lawyers there who are there under contract. If ICANN were to designate a representative of the GNSO user side and a representative at large as part of their negotiating team, the registrars may not like it, but I don't see why it's a subject of discussion. ICANN can simply set any reasonable negotiating team that they want. Can they not? Am I missing something here? Because I haven't heard that issue being discussed from that point of view at all.
And I don't think we've explored that. I would at least express one of the concerns raised by the registrars that they wanted to be able to engage in frank discussion that maybe is not in the public world realm, if you will, because these issues affect their businesses and their business models. But, you know, something certainly to explore. I don't know where we would stand on that particular issue.
I think that's why lawyers created non-disclosure agreements. There are ways around this. As I said, it may not be their first choice, but this is a bilateral negotiation, and I don't think ICANN is saying which registrars we want in the room and which we don't. They will select a team of people to represent them. And certainly users cannot unilaterally in this team make a position that the other people, including presumably ICANN counsel and lead registrar liaison people, will also be there. And at large cannot necessarily, but I don't see why at large or the GNSO or any other group that ICANN deems to have interest in this process cannot be part of the ICANN negotiating team. And I would really like to see that explored. Related to that, however, we had a difficult time passing the 2009, what should have been 2008, RAA, because the terms of the RAA essentially say it will be negotiated without any involvement of the GNSO, and then the GNSO must rubber stamp it for it to become real. And many on the GNSO took offense, I think is a reasonable term, at that process, and reasonably so. But we didn't change that process, so we're stuck with the same one again, and we're somehow now trying to finesse it. Is there any intent that maybe in this round we actually change the process so we go to what the registries have of it being a standard consensus policy? That is, consensus policies are consensus policies under the current rules, not the rules that were in place in 2001 or 1999. That doesn't alter how non-consensus policy issues are negotiated. That's still a private issue. But at least the consensus policy part could be normalized with the rest of ICANN's practices, and it would be nice if that was part of what came out of this phase, since we forgot it last time.
I want to clarify some of the comments that you made, because I don't think we view the contract the same way that you've described it. The contract actually has a place for the council in approving the new form of agreement. It doesn't talk specifically about who needs to be at the negotiation table, so it's that part's interpretation. But that is certainly something to explore, whether the amendment process can be changed. The other thing to remember is that in the past, the GNSO Council has been involved in contract issues such as the we had a PDP in 06 on the registry agreements. So that's, there's certainly precedent for the GNSO Council being involved in the amendment form and providing guidance on what the agreements should say.
Yeah, but PDP 06, though, was an advisory statement to the board and not an integral part of negotiations with registrars, with registries. So it's a different animal, yeah.
James, and then we have Danny has posted a question in the AC room. So James and then Danny.
Hi, thanks. Actually, this is not directly related to the presentation at hand, but it's on the related topic that I thought it would be good to bring out for perhaps the chairman, chairwoman to consider. As we know, there are certain CCTLD, which I won't name, that has been just launched their IDN TLDs, and they are some bad actors, especially on their registrar, that has been doing cyber-squatting and front-running of the registration. I understand that this is not the preview of GNSO, it's not part of this RAA, but is there any basis that we can help or should be looking at to try to uniformize or harmonize some of these RIA principles across the CCTLDs?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have a very different role with respect to CCTLDs and the because we have direct contracts with the registrars for the GTLDs, and that's how, you know, these policies and procedures get implemented. We have a much different approach with CCTLDs, and the CCTLDs have much more freedom and flexibility to do what they wish. So I don't see any scenario where we can dictate to a CCTLD, you know, what they can do with respect to their registry.
I understand the history and I understand the rules and responsibility pretty well. I'm just pointing out that while we may not be able, when we say we, I mean I can, may not be able to control what CCTLD does with their registrars, that does not forbid ICANN to make recommendations on best practices mm-hmm. to CCTLD registrars.
That's right, and that would be something that should be encouraged through the CCNSO. They have their own PDP process, and I'm not that familiar with how they do it, but that sounds like it could be a good topic for that.
And James, if there's two points here. First of all, we're about when we finish with Margie, and we're not yet finished with Margie. We do have compliance issues that we're talking about. We may revisit this again, and of course we have a liaison opportunity into the CCNSO. If you want to get the support of the ALAC to ask this question of the CCNSO, I think that would be a way forward. Okay, Danny, is there any voice in this AC room, or do we need to read his question to the record? He's on a Digo?
No, only a Digo.
Oh, okay, so unless he's on a Digo, we can't hear him. So if someone with better vision than I am can read Danny's question to the record, that would be appreciated.
Okay, that Danny is asking, is it true that these amendments, if not adopted as consensus policies, would only go into effect during the next renewal cycle, 4 to 5 years into the future?
That's the way the RAA is currently written, that if a new form is approved by ICANN, and that involves the process we described with the GNSO Council, that new form comes into play when the registrar renews its contract. But as in the past, for example, in 2009, ICANN developed an incentive program to get more registrars on the new contract, and I believe it's a fairly significant number of registrars that are covered now by the new contract. So that is true that it comes in through the amendment process, and it may take a series of years before we get there, although incentives may speed up the number of registrars that get on the new contract.
Does Jenny have a follow-up? But not being able to read the AC room with such small print, I can't see whether he's put a follow-up in or not.
He has not yet.
Okay. All right, then I'll go across to Alan. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I do have a follow-up, though. There are still a significant, but not a majority, of registrars who have not signed the new agreement a year and a half into it, all 2 2/3 into it. So it is an issue. I will point out that there are elements of the RAA which are subject to consensus policy, and if adopted as a consensus policy, are in effect immediately, but those must go through the formal PDP process, which takes almost as long as the 5 years for approving contracts, but not quite.
That is correct. Eric, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Eric Brenner-Williams. Hi, Margie. I'm following up on the exchange you and Alan had about the interest or standing of designated persons or parties to the negotiations between ICANN and the and particular registrars. So I'll just read something that I wrote. We have some policy interest in knowing if the contract negotiation is between ICANN and one of the 100 or less public-facing registrars, or between ICANN and one of the 600 or so shell registrars. Our public interest arises from the issue of whether there is a general public interest or only a secondary market interest in the consumer-facing behavior of the registrar conducting negotiations at the moment. So that's I'm asserting that there is some rationale for us to inquire if the actual negotiation involves a public interest or does not involve a public interest. Thank you.
Margie, obviously that's not something you can respond to, but I'd like to hear it taken on notice and got back to us about.
So, Eric, if I can follow up, we're in the process of trying to figure out what the next steps are, and are you suggesting that we should set rules on how registrars participate, at least on their side of the negotiation? I guess I'm not understanding the question clearly.
Thank you, Margie. The suggestion Ellen made is that there's a public interest in the negotiations between ICANN and registrars, and individual registrars, and that public interest can be addressed by the presence of persons which are not ICANN employees, that is, are acting on ICANN's behalf, either through contracted external counsel or through non-disclosure-bound persons who are not external counsel. But whom acquire some degree of fiduciary and or non-disclosure obligations by being parties to this contract, to the contract negotiations. So assuming that there is some, that the issue of standing of persons who are not ICANN employees or external counsel is admitted as a hypothetical for the moment, we then need to ask if there is a public interest in the negotiation itself. Or to what degree the public interest actually exists. So to pick, let us say, a large registrar with 25% of the market that offers general registrations to users as one data point on the spectrum of all registrars, and to pick one of, say, 130 registrar credentials owned by a registrar holding company and whose 130th instance of their general holdings engages only in backorder markets, that is, as part of a drop pool acquisition system and has no public-facing existence whatsoever, except for the de minimis requirements in Section 3 of the RAA, that the public interest in the first case is fairly obvious. The public interest in the second case is inobvious or certainly very distinct. And so if there is a public interest in the relationship between ICANN and registrars, and I think we might be able to agree that there is generally, and if that interest is available through the contract negotiation between ICANN and each individual registrar or group of registrars, then the issue of standing of parties who represent the public interest in addition to ICANN is a legitimate question to ask. And so that's how I'm attempting to support Alan's point, not to speak to whether there are rules about registrars present, but rather whether or not the issue of standing of non-ICANN employees and non-external counsel in any particular discussion meets the issue of public interest that rises to some reasonable support for the request or the suggestion that Alan has made.
I understand your question. I guess the question is, how is the public interest how does that fit into the process? And unfortunately, the contract is not clear, right? I mean, and so that's why we're having the debate in the GNSO Council, and that's why we have the divergence of opinions in the working group. But I understand your point. I mean, there's, you know, even in the contract with the setup that the GNSO Council must approve the new form, that's, you know, that's an indication that the community interest needs to be heard. And the question is, how is it heard and how does it fit into the process? I can't answer what the right answer is, but I understand your concern.
If I could give one more extreme case, there are registrars which execute no registrar function during the lifetime of their registrar contract. They are registrars for a particular corporate purpose, and it doesn't involve registrations available to the public. In fact, one of the original 6 testbed registrars is in that class. So clearly there's no public interest where the holding of the contract is merely for a corporate goal and does not involve any registration activity and certainly not any public-facing activity by the registrar as a registrar of record of only its own corporate domains. Thank you.
Okay, Bo.
I just wanted to echo that I think it would be a good measure for some other representatives from the public. Well, actually, 2 points. I think there is public interest in the negotiating process between ICANN and registrars, but I think we need to do a better job of creating public interest. I think the public needs to know what it is that they should be concerned about. Otherwise, the whole process continues to exist in a sort of vacuum. But second, I would echo what Eric said and what Alan said. I think having the presence of someone who had some expert negotiating or legal ability from the user side would be beneficial. I mean, I was co-chair of one of the work teams, and my co-chair was Michelle Nalon. Well, you know, or Michaela Nalon. He's a great guy, but, you know, he's a registrar. I'm not a lawyer, you know, so the public interest gets represented by some person who simply does not have the legal ability to be able to deal with contracts. So obviously we should have more brain power in these work group negotiating situations.
I think that just has to be a so noted. And I guess the other thing is that it's a very good reason why we need more and more voices engaged, because we need to have the puddle of brain power to pull from. We at the moment we're overworking our under-resourced at-large community, and we do need to have the right talent pool. And I'm saying that deliberately because I see a wonderful lineup of fellows that I talked to this morning, and I suspect there's some talent pool over there that could be very well involved in these work group activities as just described. I just have just one moment before I let you escape. You know, you're not going to escape. Not going to escape till I let you go. Okay. There was, in fact, a response from Danny, so I just want to make sure that's closed off, and then I promise I'll let you go. And you will get back to us on these other discussions. Yes. Thank you, Auntie. The new GTLD contract is pretty much a pure adhesion contract. That is to say that registries must abide by a whole host of regulations. Why then can't we treat the RAA similarly as an adhesion contract that would similarly eliminate all registry negotiations? That's Danny Younger.
I don't think that I can agree that this is a contract of adhesion. I think the legal team would be very upset. Okay. But I think we're in 2 different situations. With the new GTLD program, in a sense, we've got a clean slate. You can announce the new agreement and you can fix things that may have been a problem in the past. But on the registrar accreditation agreement, that agreement's in place. It's currently working. And so we have the limitations of what's actually in the contract in amending it. So there are 2 very different situations. And if we were starting from scratch on the registrar accreditation agreement, I would think we would have a very different agreement. But it reflects a lot of the history, you know, and from the beginning of ICANN. And so we're just dealing with 2 different situations. I hope that adequately answered the question.
I think that more than adequately responds. Whether it answers the question is another question. Margie, thank you very much. And it is a joy having you here. We always give you a slightly tough time, but we appreciate your resiliency, your stability, and your security. And
thank you,
thank
everybody.
You
bye.
Our next victims... oh, come on. If we can't have fun, we shouldn't be doing it. Stacey, you might need to get the mic organised across, and Pam is also going to be available here to answer some questions. Now, this is something very close to our hearts, ladies and gentlemen. We are now moving into compliance issues. Without compliance, we all feel the whole thing is pretty scary indeed, and it's through compliance, of course, that some of the measurements and tools we have to rectify some of the issues that at the consumer and end user end of the spectrum are become obvious to us. So to introduce both Stacey and Pam, I've got Stacey on my right, I've got Pam on my left. Stacey's going to do the presentation, correct? And it's queued up, so it's over to you.
Good morning, ALAC members. Again, my name is Stacey Burnett. I'm the Director of Contractual Compliance. And I don't know how many of you have met Pam Little. She's our Senior Director in the Asia-Pacific region. And she's been a valuable addition to our team thus far. I think she's been on our team for about a year and some months. And she's been successful in resolving a number of complex compliance issues with some of our Asian registrars. And she's multilingual, and that's just been a huge addition to our staff to have someone who can communicate with our registrars in their native language. So I hope at some point during the week you'll make time to chat with Pam and get to know her better. So without further delay, I'll start my presentation. I wasn't sure of the knowledge level of this group concerning our contractual compliance program, so I included some information, just general information about our program, and then I will share with you some enforcement statistics and some of our ongoing work, and then I will conclude by sharing with you our plans concerning our staffing deficiencies. We're trying to work to fill some of those staffing deficiencies, and I'll share with you what we're doing. So I'm starting with some basic information about the program. We manage relationships with over 900 ICANN-accredited registrars and 17 registries. And when I say manage relationships, what I mean is we regularly reach out to registrars whenever there is suspected noncompliance or actual noncompliance, and we attempt to resolve those issues informally. And that usually involves creating relationships, because if you're contacting the same entity about various problems, then you do end up developing a relationship. And again, our first attempt is always to resolve issues informally via email or through telephone calls, and when that is not successful, then we have to take escalated actions. We're also responsible for, of course, enforcing the contracts, investigating claims of noncompliance, managing consumer complaint systems. We have two consumer complaint systems. We call one the C-ticket system, which means general complaints, and then we have another one called the Who Is Data Problem Report system. And that system receives complaints about who is inaccuracies. We're also responsible for developing processes for addressing compliance issues. And it's our goal to treat registrars and registries equitably. And so we have to develop processes for addressing different compliance issues like the breach process, the termination process, various processes so that we are not accused of treating different parties in a different manner. So I wanted to go through some of the RAA provisions that are frequently talked about in the community and share with you our contractual authority. Some people in the world believe that ICANN is a government entity, which we're not. We don't have regulatory authority. We're not a police entity. Our authority is strictly contractual. If provisions aren't in the contract, then we can't enforce them. And so we're often approached about content issues, which we can't address because those provisions are not in our agreements to address. And so, again, we're only able to enforce provisions contained in our RAA agreement and our registry agreements. And some of the more talked about provisions concern WHOIS and accuracies. The RAA requires registrars to investigate all WHOIS and accuracy claims. It does not require registrars to provide accurate WHOIS information, and I think that's a misconception in the community. The requirement is that the registrar investigate WHOIS inaccuracies. The RAA allows registrars to cancel a domain name if they're unable to verify WHOIS information, but it doesn't require that. They can suspend the domain name. There are options that they have. Also, the RAA allows a registrar to cancel a domain name when the registrar willfully provides inaccurate WHOIS information. Another important provision that is frequently discussed is concerns RAA escrow requirements. Registrars are required to escrow their registration data in the event of registrar failure. ICANN has a process in place to acquire the data so that registrants aren't harmed during a registrar failure. Also, the RAA requires registrars to comply with the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy. And then there are termination provisions that allow ICANN to proceed with terminating a registrar's agreement if one of the registrar principals is convicted of certain crimes. And as you all probably know, we can of course, proceed with termination when a registrar fails to cure a breach that the registrar has been put on notice of. And the next slide, please. And this graphic just gives you an idea of how many terminations and non-renewals we've had over the past several years. And where we are today, year 2010. Thus far, we've terminated and non-renewed 13 ICANN accredited registrar agreements. Next slide. We have begun keeping records regarding how many compliance notices we've sent to registrars. And these compliance notices are notices identifying a contract breach in most instances, or they can also be inquiry notices where we believe we have information about a contract breach, but we're inquiring with the registrar to get information to determine if it actually is a contract breach. And from August to November, we've sent out 1,588 compliance notices. And I know there has been lots of discussion during this ICANN meeting about what is compliance doing. There are provisions that compliance is not necessarily enforcing. But from our perspective, we are taking aggressive action to enforce the terms of the RAA. And our experience has been over the past 18 months, when we send these compliance notices, registrars respond and take action and correct. And it lessens the need for us to send a number of breach notices because they respond to these compliance notices that we send. So I wanted to share with you information about some ongoing audits that we're engaged in. We've recently conducted an inter-registrar transfer policy audit, and there are some important reasons why we believe we should conduct this audit. Number one, we often receive a large number of complaints about transfer issues, and there are policy considerations being discussed currently about changes to the inter-registrar transfer policy. And so we thought it was timely to conduct an audit in this area to determine if there was significant registrar noncompliance. And we haven't published our findings yet. However, I wanted Pam to share with you the methodology, or a little bit about the methodology that she engaged in to conduct this audit.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Basically, we selected four groups of registrars to look at their business practices and processes to see whether they are in compliance with the policy. So these four groups are the registrars who nagged transfer requests most, or who gained transfer requests or attempting to gain transfer into their registrar but get nagged, their requests get nagged most. So we select from a particular month, the top 5 or 10 from those groups. But we also looked at the tickets, the consumer complaints we get each month. And we select a particular month, and we select the top 5 most complained about registrars in terms of their transfer issues. So we looked at those 5 registrars. Sorry, you have a question? Okay. We look at the tickets, and we ask them to respond to. We look at how they respond to those consumer complaint tickets to determine whether they are in compliance with the policy. We also, in order to avoid, so-called penalizing larger registrars because they tend to have, more number of complaints, we actually look at the medium registration portfolio among those registrars who were complained about and only select the top 5 that exceed that medium portfolio size as another group. So overall, we have found very consistent patterns among some registrars. We're hoping to have a discussion in about half an hour with the registrar stakeholder group about our preliminary findings and some of the issues and concerns they have, and hopefully to share with the community our audit results or findings very shortly. And that's one of the things we really want to improve on, is get to you, people in the community, more real-time communications about what we're doing, compliance activities, enforcement actions, rather than for you to wait for 6 months later or 12 months later to know what we've been doing or haven't been doing. Okay, that's all about IRTB, and I'm happy to answer any question later on when we have time.
Another audit that we are engaged in concerns Port 43 access. We've developed a tool. Can you go back to the previous slide, please? Right, thanks. We've developed a tool that monitors all of our ICANN accredited registrars' Port 43 tools. And so we're doing this to ensure that the public has access to WHOIS information, and that's consistent with ICANN's commitment to ensure WHOIS accuracy to the extent that we can based on the provisions contained in our contracts. And so based on this tool that we've been using to monitor Port 43 access, you can go to the next slide, whoever's doing that. Thus far, we've sent 6 compliance inquiries, and we just started using this tool about a month ago. We've sent 6 compliance inquiries, and we issued 2 breach notices based on the information we found from these registrars who didn't appear to be providing Port 43 access. And we had previously given them notice by sending one of our compliance notices from that chart that you saw, and 2 of the 6 2 of the registrars that we sent a compliance notice to failed to respond to our notice, and that's why we sent them a breach notice. And we're going to continue to use this tool, and I suspect that once registrars understand that we are actively monitoring their Port 43 tools, that they will increase compliance in this area, and you won't see as many problems concerning WHOIS access. I mentioned earlier that one of the complaint systems that we manage is called the WHOIS Data Problem Report System. And again, that's the system that ICANN put in place to allow the public to report WHOIS inaccuracy claims. And we are making some enhancements to this computer tool so that the public is able to find out fairly quickly what happened concerning their who is an accuracy claim. And so number one of the enhancements we're making concerns reports that are received through the system that are invalid. Often people use the system and they report a who is an accuracy claim about a name that's already been suspended, deleted, or the name is expired. And that's not a report that we should act on because something's going on with the name. Again, it's been suspended, deleted, or expired. And so we're going to send an automatic notice back to the person who files the claim, letting them know that the name has been deleted, suspended, or expired, and we deem this an invalid report. Heretofore, we didn't have that. And so people would file claims, and they just assumed that nothing happened, it went through the system, and the system is bad. We realize it's very important to inform those who use this system what's going on with their claim. So that's one of the enhancements. Another enhancement concerns registrars letting ICANN know what they've done in response to the who is an accuracy. And so after the 15th day after the report is filed, the registrar will be sent an email from ICANN requesting information about what they did in response to the claim. And they'll have to check one of these four options. The registrar verified the contact information as correct. The second option, domain name has been suspended, deleted, or expired. Number three, the contact information was updated. Or number four, they need more time to investigate. And so once we receive that information, we can share that with the claimant who filed the who is an accuracy claim. And I think people who use this system will find that information extremely useful as opposed to having to go look up the information later to determine if a change was made. You will receive an email letting you know what happened concerning your who is an accuracy claim. Another enhancement that we're making concerning this system is an automated compliance notice is going to go out to the registrar if they haven't taken action on this claim after 45 days. We haven't done that heretofore, but that will be the new system. And the good thing about that is it's consistent with our current compliance process. I think I shared it with you earlier. We attempt to work things out informally, and so we always start by either calling a registrar or notifying them via email or in writing of a suspected noncompliance. And so by sending this 45-day notice, we're putting them on notice. We believe there's noncompliance here. If they fail to respond to us, then we're in a position to send them a notice of breach because we followed our process. So those are three enhancements. Just like any system, other enhancements will be made later. It's a process that we have to go through to make it better, and we receive comments from the public all the time about other things that we should do to make this system better and more useful. The last thing I want to talk about concerns staffing updates. We have three open positions, a senior director, a compliance manager, and the compliance manager is going to be responsible for all things related to who is, and a senior auditor. And so we are actively receiving applications, reviewing those credentials of the applicants, and holding interviews. And we're working as fast as we can to fill these positions, and it's our aim to have the positions filled in early 2011. So at this point, we'll receive questions, and that concludes my presentation.
Well, thank you, Stacey. I've got a speaking cue already. We've got a couple of questions in from Danny Younger over Skype, from the AC room, which my eyes won't let me read, so it's been Skyped to me, and I believe, Pam, you've got copies of those, so that's easy to read. Then I have Alan, then I have Bo, then I have Evan.
I see we're very popular today.
And then Mohammed, and then Eric. Yes, compliance is always popular because it's one of those interfaces which we both disdain, dislike, and a delight in when it works. So it sounds to me like you're helping to make it work better. I believe you probably have already answered the first question that Danny posed, which was specifically, but I will read it to the record, how many new compliance officers are planned to be added during the next calendar year. Now, whilst you haven't listed compliance officers per se, you have given some feedback on staffing in the next calendar year? Is there more staffing, perhaps? I can forward Danny's question to the next level now. Is there other staffing that you might be planning, Stacey?
Yes, there are additional plans for more staff. As you know, we're going to have new GTLDs, and we'll have to appropriately resource to be ready for new GTLDs, and so we have plans underway to add additional staff members.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'll interpose Danny's questions because they have come in between the other speakers as well. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. Two comments. There's been an off-stated statement or something often said that with the previous RAA, the only option available to ICANN was termination, and that was a very, I believe the expression normally used, is a very blunt instrument.
It was called the nuclear option.
The nuclear option. On the other hand, the threat of using the nuclear option is a very effective way of getting registrars to fix small problems that they have simply chosen to ignore. It was an option that could legally be used and therefore is a valid way of coercion. And it still may be valid even under the new RAA. And I don't see why ICANN would not use that. That sends a message saying we really take this seriously.
We do use it. As you saw the statistics, we've terminated and non-renewed 13 registrars thus far this year. I think it was 23 the previous year. So we do use that option.
Yeah. Well, traditionally, and I'm not talking about the statistics this year, it has tended to be used only for financial issues, but... The fact that it was often stated that we cannot use it for small things, I just have not agreed with. Okay, all that notwithstanding, I'll tell you a very short little story. I live in Montreal. For many, many years, health checks in restaurants, you know, we find cockroaches, the food is rotting, were never posted for the public, unlike some cities. And the rationale was, if we posted publicly that there are health infractions, it might hurt their business. And that's exactly the reason most other jurisdictions post them, because that is what we want to do. We want to give them some incentive to fix them, because it will hurt their business. Has ICANN ever considered doing something equivalent with registrars? That is, post on the list of registrars some statistics, you know, per 1,000 or per 100,000 of registrations, how many problems you have, how many of them get resolved, how quickly. Tell an innocent registrant what the track record is for their registrar.
We have considered something like that, but I do encourage members of the public to look at our enforcement page concerning terminations and breaches. Although registrars can cure a breach and it simply goes away if they cure it, but just seeing a notice of breach on our website gives you some indication this registrar has had a problem in the past or may be experiencing a problem presently. And that may be a registrar that you want to avoid based on the fact that escalated compliance action has been taken against that entity.
I haven't actually looked at that page, but I suspect it's organized by date or something like that.
It is.
Yeah. So if I simply pick registrar XXX, bad example, it would be a rather difficult and a challenge to me to find it, whereas I would like to go to the list of registrars and click on performance, just like I can on Amazon, to see how this vendor rates.
Well, I think you can also do a Google search, and you would probably get to information about a registrar that we've taken escalated compliance action against.
The problem with the Google search is every registrar, no matter how good, will have people saying that they are horrible, and here's the reason why. So it has to be a relative thing related to the number of domains and such. Thank you.
Sure. I think that might be something we can take into account or consider how to explore that. It's actually a suggestion, as Stacey has responded. We thought about this, but as everyone in this room knows, this is a consensus forum, right? And so there's one perspective, there's another perspective. I fully understand where Alan is coming from, sort of carrot and stick kind of approach, right? But we also have to consider other groups' interests and perspective as well. But if you feel that is the appropriate way to go, maybe we could, you know, encourage more people to talk about this mechanism, make it a community initiative rather than, you know, at the moment we don't have that. We actually, our process would, you know, guide us to try to resolve issues first. You know, if you are a contracted party to any organization, I'm sure you will want to be given that opportunity as well to cure the breach rather than just broadcast to the world or just terminate the contract. In fact, we can't even just terminate the contract immediately unless it's something like we have the right to do so, threaten the security or stability of the internet. Or so it's very limited. There are very limited circumstances. We can go straight to termination. But in terms of breach, we have to allow the 15 working days for the registrar to cure the breach. Yeah. As to publish a rating list, or sounds, I think, very sounds good in theory, but we need to explore how we can actually implement that. And I like to see that as a, you know, more considered community initiative. If we could have more support for that kind of thing, I think it would be a good thing.
It is a technique which is used very widely and very successfully. And sometimes, to people's surprise, you can go to Amazon, for instance, and you'll find comments there saying, Amazon is a horrible company, I'll never deal with them again. But they include it among the good things.
Okay, but we have to come up with how we rate them, you know, all the mechanisms.
I understand that, but it really would help.
Well, the mechanism obviously would need to be worked on, but it sounds like a possible project for the not-too-distant future, and I suspect you've got plenty of willing people here to assist in that. If I may, I'm going to go to Beau next, but I was going to intersperse Danny's questions, and this one goes to the latest draft terms and conditions governing registrar accreditation applications still seem to allow for the accreditation of shell corporations. Why is ICANN continuing to allow this practice? And I think you're responding to that. Go ahead, Bam.
Okay. Danny, I believe the proposed criteria, the new criteria, is being posted on ICANN website for public comment. And if you feel this is a shortcoming of the new proposed criteria, then I would encourage you to put that comment forward. How corporations structure their companies or their group of companies, and whether that's, you know, so long as it's lawful and legal in that jurisdiction, I'm not sure. I'm not understanding exactly what you mean by shell corporations and why they should not be allowed, you know, etc. I think the whole idea or the purpose of these new criteria is to really improve the due diligence process, do more checks on the applicants to make sure they, you know, have good standing and suitably qualified to be ICANN accredited registrars. As I said to you, I haven't been close to that process. That's being managed by our registrar liaison team, so I would encourage you to put your views forward and so they can take into consideration.
Thank you, Pam. Over to you.
I have a couple comments and then a question. From what I hear, I'm a little concerned that we're suggesting that the general public use Google to search ICANN data on registrar misconduct. That seems to me to be problematic for an organization that says it's so devoted to transparency and whatnot. Second is, I'm concerned, Pam, did I hear you correctly to say that you don't know what a shell corporation is?
I mean, in this context, what Danny means.
Because I suspect he's probably referring to registrars who create resellers as a means to be able to circumvent the RAA. Are you familiar with that, or?
Well, registrars are using resellers to do their registration business.
Right. Yeah.
And that's recognized in the current 209 RAA.
And has the compliance department taken any action on that, or?
In terms of.
Well, let's move on to what I think is the elephant in the room, and that is the compliance department has basically lost three of its staff. Why was David Giza fired? I mean, if it's not a, obviously, I don't want to, you know, delve into a
That's a not acceptable question. What is acceptable is why staffing isn't replaced in a timely manner.
I think it is an acceptable question. I think when a substantial portion of the community believes that the compliance department has been told not to basically enforce the rules, and that's prompted some people to either quit or be fired, then that's a major concern and it needs to be addressed. There's been no communication from ICANN about the situation in the compliance department. I had to bring it up yesterday to Kurt Pritz before he even talked about it. And from what I heard from Kurt Pritz, ICANN, and I may be mischaracterizing what he said, but from what I heard him say, ICANN is not even sure whether it has the authority to enforce compliance or not. Do you have a comment on that?
What might be appropriate, Beau, because I think we're getting into the areas of HR issues, and I'm not privy to any reason why it should or shouldn't be answered, but I am getting very nervous about asking a question directly about an ex-employee and mechanisms of their leaving the organisation.
May I rephrase the question?
You can. Thank you.
Has the compliance department been told by ICANN? Has the compliance department been told by ICANN to back off anything that's not specifically a notice of breach for non-payment?
No. I wanted to address the first issue that you raised, Bo, because perhaps I miscommunicated something. We had a gentleman that suggested that we come up with a system to allow the public to get information about registrars' compliance record with ICANN. We publish our escalated compliance notices on ICANN's website on the compliance page. That's there for the public to see. However, for someone who doesn't know anything about ICANN, which I believe a significant number of people who use the internet have never heard of ICANN, if they did a Google search and put in their registrar's name, our letter would come up about whatever they didn't comply with, our breach notice or our termination notice. I wasn't suggesting, you know, to get broad information about a registrar, use Google. But if you've never heard of ICANN, our breach notice would come up. And that was the only reason I mentioned Google. I wasn't suggesting the public should research and use Google. I just wanted to share with you there was a way to get access to our notice if you've never heard of ICANN.
And can I just very quickly respond to the reseller issue? We do recognize it is a problematic area, and 209RA tried to address some of the issues, flow down some of the responsibility. In fact, we just had one discussion yesterday with some key registrar representatives about reseller issues or transfer issues arising from this reseller model, where our position was and still is that registrars are responsible for their resellers' actions or inaction when it comes to transfer. And we repeatedly, you know, come across consumer complaints about registrants go to a registrar reseller trying to get auth code, but the reseller just doesn't take notice, doesn't deal with it. But the policy says you have to give the requester within 5 calendar days the auth code. But registrars was trying to argue, we didn't know about the request, therefore we should not be held responsible as, you know, in breach of the policy as far as that request is concerned. I say, no, that doesn't fly. You know, you are the registrar of a record. It's your obligations to make sure your resellers know what to do, what the obligations are under the policy. But I think there's room for improvement in terms of resellers' role and responsibility if we can get this next round of amendments going.
Thank you very much for that. And just as a close off to my ruling on Beau's question, I think what we do need to hear very clearly, however, is that a lack of communication about what community feels is major changes in any part of ICANN leaves a vacuum, and we will fill it with whatever we choose. If you give us information, we might choose wisely. And that's a message not to compliance, but of course to the larger ICANN communication mechanism. I now have one more question from Danny to pop in, and then we're going to Evan, and I will add you on to the speaker list. Thank you very much. Danny raises the following issue. Section 3.16 of the RAA requires registrars to provide on their website accurate contact details, including a valid email and mailing address. Is this being audited?
Sorry. Yes, that provision is being audited, and I'm sure a number of you are aware of a recent blog posting by Garth Bruin that claimed that at least 23 registrars didn't have appropriate information on their website about their email addresses and their mailing addresses. Well, we reviewed that list, and what I need to say first is that provision, 3.16, is in the 2009 RAA. Registrars operating under the 2001 RAA are not obligated to comply with that obligation. It's not in their agreement. And so of the 23 registrars that Mr. Bruin listed in his blog posting, at least 11 of them were operating under the 2001 RAA and didn't have that obligation to post their email and mailing address on their website. And so we are enforcing that agreement. Upon renewal of an RAA, a group within ICANN advises registrars that they have this new obligation in the new RAA, the 2009 RAA, and we check their website before finalizing the new RAA or consummating the agreement with the entity to make sure that they have this information on their website.
I assume that means that the other half that are under the new RAA are being pursued.
Yes, we're sending compliance notices to those. And let me say something else. One of the registrars noted in that article was recently submitted documentation requesting termination. Two were indeed compliant. And so we're pursuing the other nine and letting them know there appears to be some noncompliance. Please take action quickly to correct the noncompliance.
It's a follow-up from Bo, and then it's to Evan.
My follow-up is, why did ICANN renew the accreditation of Online NIC in 2009 in that case? Because they're clearly out of compliance with the address posting rule. They're a mail drop that operates out of China that's also a haven for domain name abuse.
When we renew the Online NIC contract, that was few months back now, I think I'm right. Their new RAA 209 RAA only came into effect on the 22nd of October 2010, but they signed the new agreement. Back then, when we were reviewing at that point for their renewal, there was no outstanding compliance issue. If you are saying to me at the moment they have other non-compliance issues, then I'm happy to look into them and address them if appropriate. But at that point, when they renewal came up, when we were reviewing it, there was no outstanding compliance issue that we were aware of.
So it sounds like it'll be fixed. One way or other, the compliance will be fixed or there'll be action taken. I'm now going to move to Evan. I have a speaking order then of Eric, Olivier, and we must stop at that point in time. I'm sure both Pam and Stacey would be delighted to... Sorry, Mohammed, I have you there. You're after Evan, in fact. You'd be delighted to take correspondence questions as well. And with the new interactive communication model that we're very excited to hear about, we're going to have the closed communication loop. Evan.
Okay, I have 3 points. One is a continuation of what you've just been talking about. And so am I now to understand that every time that somebody, such as Mr. Bruin, brings forward something to your attention, that constitutes your awareness of something, and that the clock is then ticking, and that there will be an accountability issue if ICANN does not act on these things? Because indeed, If you know of a registrar that is not complying, and at the time you renew them, you know that they're not complying, does that not set off an alarm?
Okay, so at the time of renewal, if there are non-compliance issues, they have to be addressed, or else we won't consummate a renewal agreement. If I didn't make that clear before, I apologize. That's the process. And consistent with what you said, once ICANN is notified of suspected noncompliance, we do our own investigation. We don't just trust what someone tells us. And after we investigate and determine that there is indeed noncompliance, the registrar is put on notice and given an opportunity to cure. It's informal. We don't issue a notice of breach at that point. If they ignore our request, then it's escalated. and it could amount to a notice of breach or termination if they continue to ignore us.
Okay.
So we are on notice, consistent with what you said.
Okay. And so although I know Mr. Bruin is not necessarily the most loved person within the contracted community within ICANN, I would probably bring to your attention, if you're not already aware of it, the November 20th issue of The Economist, where Garth is quoted extensively and probably gets more ink than ICANN itself. In that context, it's my understanding that he's been invited to apply for one of these three jobs. And although I'm sure there would be significant pushback from certain constituencies against him being involved directly in ICANN, at least speaking on behalf of myself, I would urge you that if he indeed applies for one of these positions, to consider him. He is extremely well-respected, not only, I think, within the at-large community, but within the law enforcement community and elsewhere at large. He is being listened to, and even though there's people here that believe that he is spewing garbage, I'd say most of the rest of the world believes otherwise, and I would ask you to take that into consideration.
I don't think that needs a response.
Okay. My second point is given what you were saying about Google, I assume that means that you are now paying Google to help raise the search order so that the ICANN letter will show up first in results. That usually involves paying some money to Google to boost things up in the search rankings, and I assume since you're referring us to use Google for this, that you're then contracting with Google AdWords in order to make sure
Thank
they show
you,
up.
Evan.
And the last one is a philosophical issue that may not be for you to answer, but for at large to consider. And is there a philosophical issue that we need to deal with that ICANN, as a body that engages in a contract with registrars and registries, has the registrars and registries together comprising 50% of the policy-making body that develops the contract to deal with these other parties? Is there something, this is something that has always bothered me about ICANN being on one side of a contracted relationship, and yet these same contracted bodies comprise 50% of the policy development process of how to make the contract with themselves.
And I'm sure you've taken that as the advice and information it is. It's not something that requires a response. And I guess you're collecting funds for the Garth Bruin support. I'm not sure we should do non-sponsored ads. Perhaps we'll have to get you to declare interest in the future.
No, I was just wondering if there was any budget to pay for Google to boost up the search results.
Okay, no, I would think that's something perhaps marketing might look at then. Write it down and send it on. Now, Mohammed, please.
Just two questions. One, what did the compliance department did in 2009, which is jumped the number of compliance termination from 7 to 20, and that was in slide 7 in your presentation. And the other question is, I think you need to have to do more efforts regarding reflecting what you're doing in ICANN website, especially for the registrant. I was just trying to find your information. It's very hard to find it, actually, on the website. So you need to do more effort on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. Is first question, Stacey, did you understand the first question about the 20?
Yeah, in your presentation, slide 7,
yep.
There's a huge jump in the termination from 7 to 20
uh-huh.
in 2009. What's the reason?
What's the reason? Stacey, can you respond to that?
We had more staff available. We had completed the development of several processes to follow up on breaches, and so we were using those processes. What we're finding now, and you can ask members of the registrar community, is registrars are taking action on our informal notices, and we don't get as much we don't get as many registrars ignoring our compliance notices, and so I think our compliance notices are being taken seriously because they saw so much action in 2009. And so we have taken some action in 2010, but the spike went up because we had staff and we were following through like we're following through now, but I think in 2010 we're seeing more registrars comply through the informal process because they're aware we'll escalate.
And your second comment about more information for registrants and users, we definitely take that on board, and we'll try to improve that. As you know, the whole ICANN website is now under renovation. That's a project that our communications department is in charge of. But we would, you know, within our compliance department, our webpage, trying to make sure that relevant information, necessary information is available to consumers and registrants. In fact, we are doing that already in the piecemeal fashion, but we want to make sure we sort of also have more comprehensive information covered.
Thank you very much. And, of course, I was tempted to say they hired Pam. That would seem obvious, you know, Pam comes on and the numbers go off, but perhaps it's not quite so simple. Okay, Eric, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm awake and now sitting on another side of the partition or the siloing of knowledge within ICANN. I'm personally quite glad that compliance has followed up on the fees owed by the domain tasting registrars that didn't correct their tasting engines and incurred fatal cost vulnerabilities, as the domain tasters as registrars really don't meet the public interest test. So I'm very pleased with the pursuit of the financial liabilities that these fairly careless parties exposed themselves to because their underlying actions were not in the public interest. I want to take the opportunity to read into the record what I also read into the record at the D.C. consultation in January of 2009 on the issue of how many registrars there are and whether or not we can distinguish between kinds of registrars. So if you'll bear with me for the moment it takes me to read this. This is reflecting data as of a year ago. There are 529 ICANN-accredited registrars in the United States. Of these, four companies control 318. Enom controls 116, DirectIPDR controls 47, Dotster controls 51, and SnapNames controls 104. Another 122 accreditations are owned by only 23 companies. What is left are 136 registrars that appear to be independent. So that would make 136 the realistic count for U.S.-based or North American-based registrars, not 529, which just happened to be a number that was mentioned at that meeting. So just considering the U.S. portion, or five of the 500 of the 900 or so registrars, there really is only about a third of that number that actually are registrars which are public-facing. And if the same distribution exists for the remaining 300 and 750 of registrars globally, there are really only about 200 actual registrars which offer services to the public. So it's significantly less than 900. Oh, thank you. I should speak up. So my point in saying this is that I suggest that compliance can treat registrars equitably and still distinguish between registrars which are public-facing and registrars which are shell registrars or not public-facing or which exist for other purposes than a public interest than public registrations and the attendant public interest. With that read, I want to observe that there are very few registrars in Latin America and fewer still in Africa and fewest in the Middle East and North Africa, where I think there are exactly two. For the compliance function to assist registrars in these regions with curable breach is in the public interest. And assisting registrars in North America and Europe may be also in the public interest, but it is distinguishably less so than assisting those registrars in these regions with curable breach issues. This came to mind because I just happened to notice one of the compliance letters was not for a financial issue, one of the recent ones. It was for a whois issue, and it was for a registrar located in South America, where there are, I think, only six registrars total for the entire region.
Open system.
Yes, I'm speaking of open system. And I'd like to help them, but I don't speak Portuguese.
May I respond?
I'm not finished, but yes. Yes, you may.
Concerning that registrar, we have a team member on ICANN staff who speaks Portuguese. And just before I left to come to Cartagena, we had an hour and a half meeting with the representative from Open System and our team member who speaks Portuguese fluently. It was five people in our office, and she had some of Flavia as the representative. She yes. had her technical person on the phone, and we communicated in her native language to resolve the compliance issue. I think we're near resolution so that we won't have to take escalated compliance action and terminate that registrar. And that's the beauty of having people on staff who speak a number of languages. We can call on their assistance to try to resolve things without them being terminated necessarily. So I think that was actually a successful case where ICANN used its resources to try to help the registrar mm-hmm. so the registrar wouldn't be terminated.
I agree. That is very helpful. I thought that there was perhaps an A record miscoordination and also a who is, an R who is implementation that was misconfigured. And fixing either one of those two problems was sufficient to meet the contractual obligation and not merely the contractual obligation, but to actually meet the public interest of having the who is service. So, yes, I think this is a victory, and I hope I'm very pleased to hear your response on this one.
It's interesting, though, because I get from the community two different sets of energy. There's you who are saying it's good to help registrars so that we don't have to resort to the nuclear option. And then I get from another part of the community, you know, get these guys. They're all bad. Get rid of them. You need to have 500 notices of termination listed. And I believe our role is to enforce the contract, but to initially try to improve compliance informally. There are registrars who are out of compliance or who are not aware that they're out of compliance. And so to treat them harshly and just try to go forward with termination when I think it's appropriate to give them an opportunity to cure, and that's what the contract allows. I'll stop there.
I agree. There is a, you are hearing two different or many different points of view, some categorical, some not categorical. I'm suggesting that one can distinguish between registrars based on a number of criteria. For instance, distinguishing between public-facing and non-public-facing registrars, between registrars that engage in intentional breach behavior and registrars that don't engage in intentional breach behavior. There are a number of different criteria that allow one to reasonably distinguish between registrars. I'll now continue with some observation of the WHOIS tool in practice.
Okay.
The WHOIS tool queries a registrar approximately hourly. The query is for a null string. Except for about, 24 and 160, so a very significantly less than a quarter even, of the queries are for a non-null string. Of those queries, they're for a very small subset, in fact, four names in the sample that I have. So, the representation of the WHOIS tool as a device that checks for the substance of WHOIS, I think, is slightly misleading. To check on the availability or the existence of the ability to connect to port 43, that would be an accurate description of the WHOIS tool at the present. I think it can be improved significantly. Asking for empty queries merely tells you that there is an alive WHOIS server at the other end. Asking for the same query over and over again would be useful if it was a highly requested name in the first place by other sources, and I don't know how you would arrive at that knowledge. And then it would be, again, useful if one were comparing each hour's or each day's worth of sample, each sample for that name for the previous one to determine if there had been any change. So at present, it's really just a heartbeat detector, and I think that can be improved. So that's the observation of who is query tool in practice.
May I comment?
Please do.
If I gave the impression that this tool was being used to assess whether, you know, the data is adequate, the WHOIS data is are the fields adequately populated, I hope I didn't give that impression. It is simply to check whether registrars have their port 43 working. because if you can't access their whois, you'll never know what the substance of the whois is. And we get complaints frequently that a registrar's port 43 tool is not working. And so I think it is an important tool in that it ensures that registrars are providing the technical requirements that are in the contract. And we are updating the tool. This is a beta test. And I would greatly appreciate if you would put your comments in writing and send them to us. I can share this with our technical people, and we'll make some enhancements based on suggestions from the community. If you believe, and if we agree with your belief that, you know, there's some things that need to be changed to make this a much better tool, more effective. So I appreciate your comments, and I hope the room senses that we appreciate all these comments. The sarcasm, we can do it now, but the healthy, constructive comments we like.
No. There's nothing wrong with a bit of healthy sarcasm. I mean, if you're going to be in compliance, you've got to have the spine to be there. And if you haven't got the spine to be in compliance, and then you shouldn't be in the room. So I'm sure you take it in the spirit that it's meant, which is, albeit occasionally challenging, but meant to make a better model. And we are wholehearted supporters of compliance. When you hear criticism, we've been crying out for more funding for compliance, for more staffing for compliance. We're part of your support base, and it needs to be seen so. I have
I'm not quite finished.
You have to be, because I have a very brief follow-up request from Evan. It needs to be universal. Is yours a follow-up, Bo? Because these people actually need to be in another room, which is why I'm trying to work out what's happening.
Yeah, it is a follow-up. I defer to Evan. I'll go after him.
And then Olivier was lined up for some time. You're going to, Paul, you're happy, delighted to see so. You're going to defer to Evan? Okay. Thank you.
Stacey, I just want to at least say that I think those two models that you've just mentioned are not mutually incompatible. I think people want to see well-functioning registrars, but they want good action to make sure that the bad actors are out. Those two things are not incompatible. If someone's interested in playing by the rules, let's give them every opportunity to do so. If they don't, do something about it.
I think that's right. That's why Stacy used the word equitably, not equally. We don't treat them equally. We treat them equitably.
Ladies, and it's a delight to say ladies, might I say, because the gender equity on some of these things is a bit of a worry in the ICT world, and especially in ICANN. I take it that the questions that haven't been dealt with, the remainder of Eric's, and also there is still one remaining from Danny. You do have a copy of that. If it at all possible, could we have an email back on those? Mm-hmm. Are you able to put your second part in writing, or is it able to just be quickly read to the record, Eric?
Of course I can put it in writing, but wanted to ask, are you also monitoring port 80? Because both 43 and 80 are in the contract.
We haven't developed a port 80 tool yet, but I will take back that we probably need to start doing that.
Okay. Well, in that case, we only have one outstanding. You've got a copy of that in writing. It would be appreciated if we can have a copy as well as Danny, so we can close our record of that. Ladies, thank you very much for coming and playing in our sandpit. We do appreciate it. Pam's been here before, obviously. And we hope you're game to come back, Pam. We do want to hear
this is my favourite.
Okay. We haven't had you in our hot seat before. It's certainly not meant to be an inquisition, and if it came across in any way aggressive, I almost apologise for it, but it is the nature of the game. We are the client, I guess, is what we could say. So thank you, and thank both these ladies in the appropriate manner.
Thank you for having us. Keep those suggestions and comments coming. Thank you. Bye now.
Okay, now, the mid-morning break you didn't have is no longer available, but we were able to snaffle a small amount of food, which I now need to apologise for, in a very disappointing
outcome, as far as I'm concerned. It seems that the sandwiches that are over there all have meat on it. In some cases, meat that's very inappropriate for some of us to have. So those of you who do not have cultural and religious limitations may, in fact, find something to eat over there. Those of you who don't, I can only say we're sorry and we're going to do our best to fix it. So can I ask you to now get up, stretch your legs, take hold of these papers, which is the charter we're going to look at. Let's get the brain cells working with whatever mechanism of food or stimulant you can find that works for you, and reconvene in, shall we say, 10 minutes? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.